A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I spent the better part of this week wrestling with interior design software, trying to figure out a storage system for our new apartment, where the shoes go, how the cabinets actually fit against that weird angled wall, whether the drawers will clear the doorframe. And about 3 days in, I realized something. My wife is an architect. Her business partner is an interior designer. I see them go to work every day. I hear fragments of their conversations, and I have absolutely no idea what her partner actually does all day.
That's a remarkable thing to admit 3 days into a furniture crisis.
But I think it's also a pretty common blind spot. Most people, if you stop them on the street, couldn't tell you where the architect's job ends and the interior designer's begins. And the line is getting blurrier. Projects now demand tighter integration between the shell and the interior from day one. But the legal and educational lines, those are still stark. Completely different licensing, completely different training.
Yet they're sharing the same digital model, the same deadlines, the same client expectations. It's a fascinating tension. Two professions that have to work as one team, but are regulated as two entirely separate worlds.
That's what I want to get into. What does an interior designer actually do that an architect doesn't? What technical skills are now baseline requirements in that profession? And how does an effective collaboration between the two actually function? Not in theory, but on a Tuesday morning when the millwork drawings clash with the structural columns and someone has to fix it before the contractor starts asking expensive questions.
Let's lay out the actual boundary first, because it's not fuzzy at all once you look at the legal definitions. Architects are licensed to design the building envelope, the structural systems, life safety elements, the stuff that keeps the building standing and keeps people from dying in a fire. Interior designers in the 26 states that actually regulate the title are licensed for non-structural interior alterations, space planning, and finish specifications. They can move a wall as long as it's not load-bearing. They cannot touch the beam holding up the roof.
In the other 24 states, anyone with a Pinterest board can put interior designer on a business card.
And that asymmetry is huge. In a regulated state, that interior designer has passed the NCIDQ exam, which requires a CETA-accredited degree plus 3,520 hours of supervised work experience. They carry liability insurance, they can stamp drawings, they understand fire-rated assemblies and ADA clearance requirements. In an unregulated state, you might get that, or you might get someone who's really good at picking throw pillows. The client often can't tell the difference until something goes wrong.
On the architecture side, it's even more intense. NAAB accredited degree, 3,740 hours across 6 experience areas, 7 exams for the AR 5.0. So the training pipelines are almost identical in length, but they diverge completely in content.
Architecture training is organized around structural integrity and life safety. Interior design training is organized around human factors, ergonomics, finish performance, how materials actually wear over time. They're not competing expertise, they're complementary, which brings us back to your software adventure. What were you actually using?
I was in one of those consumer tools. Drag and drop cabinets, pick a finish, see if it fits. And it felt sophisticated until I described it to my wife, and she said, "Oh, that's basically a video game."
She's not wrong. The professional tools are fundamentally different beasts. Revit, AutoCAD, a program called 2020 for kitchen and bath, and something called CET Designer, which is the dominant software for kitchen, closet, and office furniture design. CET Designer doesn't just let you arrange cabinets. It has parametric constraints, built-in, load-bearing calculations, and it generates cut sheets that go directly to CNC fabrication equipment. You design the storage system, and the same file tells the factory machine how to cut the wood.
The gap between what I was doing and what her partner does is not a gap of skill level. It's a gap of category. I was arranging digital blocks. She's producing fabrication-ready manufacturing instructions.
That's the thing most people don't see. The pretty renderings are maybe 5% of the job. The rest is construction documentation. Millwork details, reflected ceiling plans, power and data layouts, specifying exactly which hinge and which drawer slide and which edge banding. All of it has to coordinate with the architect's structural model, which is where things get interesting and also where they get expensive when they go wrong. Let's get concrete about what an interior designer actually produces in a typical week, because it's not mood boards and fabric swatches. The core deliverable is space planning, adjacency diagrams that map how rooms relate to each other, circulation analysis that traces how people actually move through a space. Then you layer in FF&E, furniture, fixtures, and equipment. Every chair, every light fixture, every workstation specified down to the manufacturer part number.
FF&E sounds like a law firm.
It kind of is. The specification book for a 50,000 square foot office renovation can run hundreds of pages. And then there's lighting design, not just picking fixtures, but layering ambient task and accent lighting so the space works at 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. After that comes the construction documentation, interior partition drawings, millwork shop drawings, reflected ceiling plans, power and data layouts. This is not decorating. This is technical documentation that contractors bid from.
When my wife's partner is doing interior design, she might be specifying the exact draw slide for a custom credenza and coordinating where the electrical outlets go, relative to the baseboard detail.
Checking that none of it conflicts with the architect's structural columns or the mechanical engineer's duct runs, which brings us to the technical skill question you asked, how much CAD and BIM is actually required? The short answer, it's becoming non-negotiable. The NCIDQ exam now includes digital drafting components. And industry surveys from 2025 show Revit proficiency listed as a required skill in roughly 70% of interior designer job postings.
That's not nice to have. That's, you will not get hired without this.
It makes sense when you understand how BIM actually works. The architect owns what's called the base model in Revit. The building envelope, the structural grid, the core and shell. The interior designer doesn't get a separate sandbox. They either work in a linked model with permissions to edit interior elements, or they use specialized overlay software like CET Designer for kitchens and closets and office furniture, and then export that back into the architect's model.
Two different professionals, two different software environments, one shared digital model that has to stay consistent. What could possibly go wrong?
Let me give you a real example. 50,000 square foot office renovation. Architect designs the core and shell. Interior designer plans all the workstations, the conference rooms, the breakout spaces. They're working in linked Revit models. But a link error, a version mismatch when someone reloaded the interior model, caused the ceiling heights in the interior file to be 6 inches higher than the architect's structural ceiling. Nobody caught it until construction. The ceiling grid was already ordered. The change orders cost
$40,000. $40,000 because of a version control hiccup.
That's consistent with the 2023 Dodge Data and Analytics Report. BIM coordination errors caught during construction average $15,000 to $40,000 per incident. During design, you catch it in a coordination meeting and it costs nothing but time. During construction, you're paying for materials already fabricated and labor already scheduled.
The friction isn't really about taste or vision. It's about version control, permissions, and who updated what when.
That's where the AIA contract documents have started catching up. The B209-2024 explicitly defines interior design services as a separate scope that can be contracted alongside architectural services. It's an acknowledgement that these are two distinct professional services that need formal coordination, not just the architect handing off a shell and saying, "Decorate this."
Which also means the interior designer is getting pulled in earlier. No more waiting until the permit set is done.
With integrated project delivery and design, build becoming more common, the interior designer is at the table during schematic design, before the building shape is locked. Because if you wait until the shell is designed to start space planning, you discover things like this column grid makes it impossible to lay out workstations efficiently, or the window placement means every private office gets glare at 3 p.m. Those are expensive fixes late in the game. They're just conversations early on.
The toolchain reality is this weird hybrid. The architect owns the federated model, sets the coordinate system, controls the view templates and word sharing permissions. The interior designer has to adapt to the architect's BIM execution plan or negotiate changes to it. And meanwhile, they might be using CET Designer for the cabinetry because Revit's casework tools are clunky, and now you've got a round-trip export-import workflow that creates its own version control headaches.
That's the thing your consumer software completely hides from you. You were dragging cabinets around in what was essentially a visualization sandbox. Professional CET Designer has parametric constraints. It knows that a drawer can't be wider than the cabinet opening. It calculates load bearing for shelves, and it generates the cut sheets that tell the CNC machine exactly how to cut each panel. The same file that shows the client a pretty rendering also drives the factory equipment.
The gap between my drag-and-drop adventure and her partner's actual workflow is not just a matter of more features. It's a completely different relationship to the physical object being built.
You are arranging pictures of cabinets. She's producing the instructions that make cabinets exist. And those instructions have to live inside the same digital model as the architect's structural beams and the mechanical engineer's ductwork. That's the part that makes collaboration genuinely hard, not the design philosophy, but the data management. That data management problem creates a power dynamic nobody talks about in the glossy firm brochures. The architect controls the federated model. They set the coordinate system, the view templates, the work sharing permissions. If the interior designer needs a different view setup to document millwork properly, they're asking permission. That's not a collaboration of equals, it's a hierarchy baked into the software architecture.
The architect is basically the sysadmin of the digital building.
The interior designer is a power user with restricted privileges, which works fine if the architect understands what the interior designer needs and sets things up accordingly. But if the BIM execution plan is written entirely around the structural and MEP coordination, the interior team spends the first week just negotiating access to the model.
Which is absurd, because they're supposed to be partners.
The firms that do this well, and this is where your wife's practice structure is unusual. They establish the BIM execution plan together before anyone opens Revit. They define who owns which elements, what the linked model protocols are, and they schedule coordination reviews at 30%, 60%, and 90% design. Not just when something clashes and someone's panicking.
What does that coordination meeting actually look like? I've heard my wife mention clash detection, like it's a weekly ritual.
It kind of is. They run the model through Navisworks or Revit's interference check, and it spits out a report. Here's every place where two things are trying to occupy the same space. Structural column running through a custom credenza, ductwork passing through the ceiling coffer detail, sprinkler head inside a light fixture. Some of those are false alarms. The software flags things that would never collide in reality. But some of them are $40,000 problems waiting to happen.
The interior designer is the one flagging the credenza through column situation.
And that's where early involvement pays off. If the interior designer is at the table during schematic design, they can say, hey, that column grid you're laying out. If we shift it 2 feet, we can fit a continuous run of workstations along that wall without breaking the module. That conversation costs nothing. Having it after the structural drawings are done costs real money.
The collaboration model that actually works is equal partnership from day one, shared BIM protocols, scheduled clash detection, and the interior designer treated as a co-author of the building, not a subcontractor who shows up after the permit set.
That's exactly why your wife's practice structure, architect and interior designer as equal partners, is so rare and so smart. In most firms, one discipline is dominant. Usually, it's architecture, and the interior designers are a department within the architecture firm, or they're brought in as sub-consultants. The power imbalance is structural.
It comes with a cost, right? Equal partners split overhead on a single project fee. That's less profitable than the architect collecting the full fee and subcontracting the interior scope.
Yes, and that's the trade-off. You get better coordination, fewer change orders, a more integrated design. But your margin per project is thinner. The firms that make this work tend to be smaller, specialized, and they charge a premium because clients can see the difference in the final product. Everything feels like it was designed by one brain.
Which brings up the other asymmetry we touched on, licensing. In 24 states, the interior designer your wife is partnering with might not be licensed at all. Does that matter?
It matters enormously. A licensed interior designer has passed the NCIDQ, carries liability insurance, and can stamp drawings for permitting in regulated jurisdictions. They understand building codes, ADA and UFAS accessibility requirements, fire-rated assemblies. An unlicensed decorator, and I'm using that word deliberately, cannot do any of that. And architects know the difference. They prefer working with licensed interior designers because when the drawings go to the building department, someone who understands egress widths and flame spread ratings has signed off on them.
The two-tier market is real. Licensed interior designers who function as technical professionals, and decorators who function as aesthetic consultants. And the client often doesn't know which one they're hiring.
Until the contractor asks for a stamped millwork drawing, and the answer is, I don't have a stamp.
That's a very expensive moment of clarity.
It's part of why the profession is slowly pushing toward convergence. There are graduate programs now, Pratt, RISD, SCAD, offering Master of Interior Architecture degrees. These are explicitly hybrid programs. Graduates can sit for the NCIDQ, and in some states with additional coursework, they can take the ARE and pursue architecture licensure.
You'd be a licensed architect and a licensed interior designer. One person, both stamps.
In practice, the licensing bodies are not enthusiastic about this. NCRB, which administers the architecture exam, and CIDQ, which administers the NCIDQ, have resisted full merger. They're separate organizations with separate standards, separate revenue streams, separate turf. The profession is converging faster than the regulators are.
Which sounds familiar if you've ever looked at any regulated profession in history.
The healthcare comparison is actually useful here. Think of the architect as a primary care physician, sees the whole system, understands how everything connects, responsible for the big life safety decisions. The interior designer is the specialist. Deep expertise in a subsystem, human factors, how materials perform at the scale of the body. Both need to read the same chart, they just interpret it differently.
The chart, in this case, is the BIM model, which makes the specialist dependent on the generalist for access to the patient's file.
That's the unresolved tension. As BIM and integrated project delivery push these professions into tighter synchrony, the licensing framework still treats them as entirely separate worlds. The software demands integration that the law doesn't recognize.
Where does that leave us? The collaboration works when it's structured as a partnership from day one, with shared protocols and scheduled coordination. It breaks when it's a handoff, and the legal system is about a decade behind the actual practice.
The people who suffer are the clients who hire an unlicensed decorator thinking they're getting a technical professional, and the firms that lose $40,000 to a version control error because nobody scheduled the clash detection meeting.
All of which makes my week of dragging digital cabinets around feel even more absurd than it already did. For someone listening who's actually facing this, maybe they're renovating a house or fitting out a small office. How do they know which professional to call?
The simplest heuristic, if you're touching anything structural, you need an architect. Load-bearing walls, adding a window where there wasn't one, changing the roofline. That's stamped architectural drawings territory. But if it's purely interior reconfiguration, non-load-bearing partitions, finishes, cabinetry, lighting, a licensed interior designer can handle the whole thing, and they'll probably be more cost-effective because you're not paying for structural expertise you don't need.
If you're in one of those 24 unregulated states, you ask to see the NCIDQ certification. If they don't have it, you're hiring a decorator. Which might be fine for paint colors, but not for anything that needs to go to the building department.
Second takeaway, for the professionals in the audience. Before anyone opens Revit, establish the BIM execution plan. Define who owns which elements, agree on linked model protocols, and schedule coordination reviews at 30, 60, and 90% design, not when someone notices a duct running through a cabinet. That meeting costs an hour. The change order costs 40 grand.
Third, for me specifically, the guy who started this whole thing by dragging digital cabinets around a fake room, the software I was using is fine for roughing out ideas, but if I actually want to understand what my wife's partner does, I need to be in Revit, not SketchUp. Professional interior design software handles the parametric constraints that make something buildable, My drag-and-drop sandbox doesn't know that a drawer has clearance requirements or that a shelf has a load limit.
CET Designer 2020 or Revit with Interior Design Templates. Those are the tools that produce fabrication-ready output. Learning the basics of any of them would give you a much clearer window into her partner's actual workflow than the consumer tool you are in.
I've been playing with digital dollhouse furniture while she's been generating CNC cut sheets.
That's the gap in one sentence, which raises the question neither of the licensing bodies wants to answer. If BIM and integrated project delivery are forcing these two professions into the same digital room from day one, and if the software increasingly treats the building and its interior as one continuous model, how long before we see a single built environment license? One stamp, one liability framework, one educational pipeline that covers both.
I'd bet on never. Not because it wouldn't make sense, but because NCARB and CIDQ are separate organizations with separate revenue streams and separate turf. Merging would mean someone loses authority, someone loses exam fees, someone loses relevance. Regulatory bodies don't voluntarily shrink themselves.
The more likely path is that specialization deepens. The interior designer becomes more technical, not less. More BIM, more fabrication integration, more code expertise. And the architect becomes more of a systems orchestrator. The boundary doesn't dissolve, it just moves.
There's a wild card here, and it's the AI tools that are already showing up. Also, there's Forma, Spacemaker. These are generative design platforms that can produce both the building envelope and the interior layout from the same set of constraints. Sun angles, wind loads, circulation patterns, workstation density, feed it all in, and the algorithm gives you a building with the interior already resolved.
If the software stops respecting the professional boundary, what happens to the professions? If one algorithm can output structural beams and millwork details and reflected ceiling plans in a single pass, the distinction between who designed the shell and who designed the interior starts to look like an artifact of an earlier era.
Or it becomes even more important, because someone has to check the algorithm's work, and you'd want two different brains with two different trainings looking at different failure modes.
That's the optimistic case. The pessimistic case is that the market decides the distinction was always artificial and starts demanding one professional who can do both, at which point the licensing bodies either adapt or become irrelevant.
Something to watch. In the meantime, if you've worked on a project where the architect-interior designer collaboration went beautifully or went down in flames, we'd love to hear about it. Same if you've had your own storage system disaster. I'd appreciate the solidarity.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Peter's Bird Paradox, formulated in the 1730s, was not actually devised in St. Daniel Bernoulli, published it in the commentaries of the Imperial Academy of Science of Saints of Saintine. Petersburg. But the problem itself originated with his cousin, Nicholas Bernoulli, who first posed it in a 1713 letter. The city got the credit. The cousin got the footnote.
The cousin always gets the footnote.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Our producer is Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, tell someone who's currently staring at a floor plan and wondering who to call. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Corn. We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from law. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.